Previously.tv Podcast Network.
All right. Let's go do what we have to do. We can talk again later.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 122 for the week of July 11th, 2016. I am Cher Taxi Medallion David T. Cole, and I'm here with Kitchen Island of Shame, Sarah D. Bunting.
I see you, Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Knife Game, Joe Reed.
I see you've played Knifey Spoony before. Ow!
Pissy Cat Passenger Tari Ariano.
Well, turn your light off then.
And Eczema Cream Pharmaceutical Rep, Allison Lohup.
It's moisturizing.
And on that classy note, hello everyone, we are back. I am back from vacation, and Allison Lohuff is back with us to talk about The Night Of. Welcome, Allison.
Hello.
Thank you very
much.
Okay, thank you.
The Night Of is...
Allison suffers no fools.
That'll do, pigs.
Yeah, okay.
The Night Of is the latest, event series from HBO. It is a sort of crimey thing that stars John Turturro and a cast of HBO prestige project tertiary character actors. And it follows the case of a kid who borrows his father's taxi, picks up a Manic Pixie Dream Girl, does some drugs, does some fucking... Wakes up at the kitchen island. She's dead. Maybe he killed her. Maybe not. I was pretty excited about this. The minute I saw the casting, I thought that it would be a like True Detective season one styles project, not realizing that it was a remake of Criminal Justice series one, a British show starring Ben Whishaw and Pete Postlethwaite, RIP. I am interested to hear from our panelists who did not watch Criminal Justice, because Al and I talked about that show on Previously.tv, and I'm wondering how our experiences of the show differ if we did or did not watch Criminal Justice. Anyone?
I'll start. I would have probably guessed that this was a remake of a British show, even if I hadn't known that from the moment that the detective, whose name is Box, right? Is that his name?
Yes.
When he sits down with the suspect, Nas, and in the interrogation room, and because his manner is very reminiscent to me of how detectives are in British shows, he's not confrontational at all. And he uses a technique that I know, Sarah, you've probably read about in The New Yorker that British cops use, where it's just like, we're just trying to understand the facts. It's not aggressive. It's not trying to trick the suspect into saying anything. It's just very calmly like, tell me your side of the story, in a way that I feel like we never, ever see on American procedurals. And that guy was my favorite character, by the way. And even though he did sort of rook the kid into telling him a whole bunch of shit that he shouldn't have without asking for a lawyer, which made me very tense. Like, it's like, this kid grew up in America. He's an American citizen. Surely he's seen a cop show before and knows if they say you don't have to do it, don't do it. But I mean, that just ratchets up the tension of the episode. And I was really on the edge of my seat the whole way through. I thought it was great. Joe, what did you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think the elements in and of itself being, you know, a dead girl. Sarah, you're right in that she's in that sort of like pixie dream girl, like not a real actual person, but just sort of a means to a lot of ends. This kind of story would feel familiar, but I think it feels almost, and it's because, and I'll talk about this later, but it's probably because I'm in the mindset of watching Show Me a Hero, that I'm in this sort of like David Simon, holistic, all parts of the machine kind of place. And I think this scratched that itch a lot, where you see not just the procedural stuff, but like the kinds of procedural stuff you don't normally see, or at least you don't see all of. And like, you know, getting the guy, he gets basically brought into the police station because they don't have anywhere else to put him, because they need to go like attend to this seemingly unrelated thing, and it turns out to not be unrelated. But just the booking and the chain of custody with the evidence, and it all sort of seems to revolve around the same kind of nexus in the police station, and watching that unfold was really fascinating to me. And then it allowed these sort of personalities to emerge within that, which I thought was really cool. And I just wanted to talk very briefly about the cast, because it's one of these casts where you watch sort of like movies and you see – you sort of bemoan the fact that like actors of color don't get – they get maybe like one good chance to show off and then you don't really ever see them again. And it's – this is a movie that's giving actors that I've liked in other things where it's just like, okay, because Riz Ahmed, who plays Nas, was so good in that movie Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal. And of course, like, he's Jake Gyllenhaal, so he's going to get all the credit. But like, Riz Ahmed was really good in that movie, and it's really good to see him getting sort of a follow-up role. The guy who plays his dad was in an Iranian movie called A Separation, which won the foreign language Oscar a few years ago, and it's really great to see him again. He was fantastic in that movie. I'm really excited to see that character sort of emerge. And then the woman cop who pulls him over is named Sekhan Sengblo, I believe is how we pronounce that, and she was just Tony nominated for a play called Eclipsed with Lupita Nyong'o. So it's really sort of rewarding to see these actors who I know they can do it because I've seen them in other things, and they're getting a really good showcase here. So I like that.
Yeah, this is a great cast. It is amazing to me that they found this guy who is like the American or, you know, Pakistani American equivalent of Ben Whishaw in the original series, because his performance was really amazing. And right on that line of like being a scared boy and being a man in the world. And I thought that the actor they found for the American version, like right on that line also, which is amazing. Allison, did you agree?
I totally agree. Ben Whishaw was such a, like the nervous, nail biting, you know, like squirrel half the time in Criminal Justice. And so I remember when I was watching that show, like Tara was saying, like I was on the edge of my seat the entire time, just so scared for this kid. And I was like, do I want to go through this again? Because it was super real. And this was, I mean, it got me right away, even though I know what's going to happen if it stays true.
Me too.
But it got me right away. I loved it. I mean, I think it's totally worth watching. And if I had any doubts at all, as soon as I saw Turturro on screen, I was totally in. I love him.
I was just amazed at how slow the pacing is in this first episode. I mean, it was a 90-minute thing, but like how much stuff they leave in that you just never see. I mean, to Joe's point of like the process of how it works and the waiting. Just how much you see Nas just waiting in this lobby to see, like, are they going to figure out I'm associated with this other crime that they're investigating or not? And where do I go? And like to the point where you actually see him realize, oh, I could probably just walk out of here and it would be fine. And then that's like the last possible second when he couldn't walk out. I mean, just the way the suspense that they ratchet up with all of this kind of what would be on any other show, like just banality, you know, like it's the lack of action makes it so tense to watch. Dave, you're not really a procedural person. What did you think of the episode?
You know, it's weird to have all this sort of like waiting around, which seems very true to the process, you know, like things don't happen. You come into the station, you're not processed right away. You know,
even in the middle of the night,
am I the only one who can speak firsthand to the being arrested?
Oh, really? Do tell.
It's boring. Like it's mostly just boring. Granted, I had not, you know, I was not carrying a gigantic blood-coated knife. And I was stoned, which helped.
Also, can we just all take away the lesson from this that, like, if you ever find yourself waking up in the middle of a bloodbath of which you're not sure to what degree you participated, don't ever run back to get the knife. Like, whatever you left there, it's gone. Just go.
Anyway.
Didn't he run to get his inhaler, though?
Oh, was that? It was the inhaler. Okay.
Or maybe I'm just projecting that from the first one. I mean, I think it really is amazingly tense.
It might have been the keys to the cab, actually, that he went in and get, which, maybe? Fair.
Yeah, finish your thought, Dave.
Thank you.
Sorry.
So all the kind of slow burn stuff that seemed very true to life. And then they kind of ruin it with this live journal junkie of a character, which seems so, like, out of her element in this show. Like, it was just like from another screenplay. Like, if so much seems true, so much seems, you know, real, visceral, that character was just like, okay, like she just walked in from another project and they plopped her in. And that really took me out of it a lot, because it just seemed so. So, but after she is killed, it kind of settles into what I assume would be the tone of the series. But I think that was a misstep, the way that character was written. And
won't see her no more.
No. I didn't really get why the character, besides for the dramatic reveal, needs to put a knife in his pocket. Why would anybody put a knife in a pocket like that? It's a very pointy thing that cuts flesh. You don't put it in your pocket. I didn't really think that was something that would have happened. I think that's something you stuff under the seat and just hope nobody checks. But you're right, the slow burn stuff. Well, I mean, these are things that take me out of it, right? I mean, that was written so that it could be the reveal at the station, but it just didn't seem like something that would happen. And they're kind of conveniences that the writers allow themselves that maybe could have been written a different way. The police process, as slow as it is, and the way that the lawyer kind of stumbles upon it and everything like that, it is like an interesting, slow burn, dramatic building process that really works. And, you know, Joe was mentioning earlier about Nightcrawler, and I feel like it almost has that kind of feel to it, you know, except where things are slow, and then there's like this action-packed moment. Things are just always slow, and it's just sort of like this powder keg waiting to blow up. And it kept me going for episode two, even after I thought the first half was a little weird of this episode.
Yeah,
it's sort of a unfortunate aspect of both versions that you are more than happy that the girl gets killed. Like, I feel like yes. Maybe that's, I mean, they only have a limited amount of time to sort of flesh out, as it were, this poor woman before she just becomes like kind of the MacGuffin pixie dream girl that sets everything in motion. But I felt the same way about the British one, that it was like, okay, like, I know the premise of the show. Anytime someone wants to kill her, I'm good with it.
I do feel like there's probably a case to be made that because of the sort of relative low-key quality to everything else in his life before and after, that little sort of oasis of, for lack of a better term, like exoticism in that encounter would sort of at least explain why he would have, you know, kept himself in that situation. And it's very sort of like heightened and stylized and kind of like cinematic, even maybe for cinematic sake. But like, I can at least sort of fanwank that.
It felt like something out of True Detective, not this show.
Oh, yeah. 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 Well, and you could see why HBO would be, you know, interested in that for that
reason. There's that like after hours-y feeling to it, meaning the Scorsese picture that...
Right.
Like, the city is strangely empty, and yet there's always someone watching.
Crazy around.
And also that similar quality to Griffin Dunne's character in that movie of, like, here you're supposed to feel that the character is sort of powerless within the system, but then I think the part of the lead-up to this is to show that he really does not have any active agency in his life, generally. So while he is being buffeted to a certain extent by, you know, criminal justice, then, you know, how much of that is the system and how much of that is his personality's buffetability?
Yeah. And I think you see a little bit of that quality in the presentation of suspects as you go through, where it's like there's a lot of people sort of like paying curious attention to the things that that Naz and the girl are doing, whether it's the second friend of the two guys who give them a hard time as they're walking into her building, the one that we don't see show up again at the police station, who I seem to be fixating on now in terms of like suspects, but like there's the weird guy at the gas station putting out a cigarette in the window, and that kind of stuff just feels heightened, but in a way that like, oh no, we're supposed to be paying attention to this.
So right. Everybody's in for the duration?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
What were you going to say, Allison?
Oh, I was going to say that I feel like in the British version also, those, you know, extraneous, you know, random people on the street, they do come back in ways that you just don't think, you know, these witnesses and their statements and the looseness of them and how they can damn a person, you know, when what they're seeing is really very innocent. It's a great show. And yes, I'm in as well.
As long as we don't find out that lady's cat was named like Gossamer or something like that, I guess I can stick around.
I'm not sure the cat's name is Gossamer.
About the show as you guys are, but I do enjoy a show that takes its time. If it is interesting, I put a pin in that one. We'll talk about something that relates to that later in the show. But certainly this is well-crafted, and I really do like the detective character. Mm-hmm. I'm so sick of the gruff, yes, hard-drinking, yeah, you know, career cop who blah, 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 that this is a refreshing change of pace.
That actor, by the way, Mr. Elizabeth Marvel in real life.
Get out of here.
Oh. Yeah.
I knew you would notice that.
She Thanks, was at
Joe.
The Tonys. He was a Tony nominee this year, and all of a sudden they cut to him in the audience, and there she was. I was like, ah.
Oh, I liked him in Manhattan, too. He was good. Yeah. Yeah, I'm in for sure.
Coop, there he is. Coop, there he is. Coop, there he is.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Blotter Presents is back, and so is a topic near to Dave's heart. DB Cooper.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, basically we really only included this segment so that we could hear the music. But DB Cooper Case Closed is a two-night event on History Channel that, as you listen to this, will have concluded last night, Monday night. I have watched one night of it as we record this. It's fairly typical History Channel fare in terms of like the filler, the B-roll of detectives and journalists, like, you know, behold me detectiving and reportering and, you know, typing meaningfully. But it's pretty good. Like, it's pretty interesting. They did the deep dive into the case itself, which it's always a crapshoot with these shows if you know the case pretty well, because it can be really boring. They did it really well. They threw in some information that I didn't know about before. They reviewed some of the more crazier suspects, and then the investigators on this show were shown like just staring into the middle distance and trying not to crack up at this lady, Marla Cooper, who's like, my Uncle Dewey, like, no, like, you lost me at Dewey. That's not a thing that happened. And also, I completely forgot there was a suspect that is a trans person, and she had already transitioned by the time the skyjacking took place. So I'm not really clear on their timeline there. But anyway, it's a good overview. It's not too much filler. And the suspect that they have come up with, which you finally get to hear in the last like 5 minutes of the 2-hour first episode, like, I'm in so far, but, you know, like, it's a little cheesy, but if you like the case, this is worth watching. You can just sort of fast forward to the halfway point of the first one if you're watching it on demand and jump in from there. But, yeah, DB Cooper. I still don't know if it's case closed. Right now, it's still case closed.
I love when they put a question mark in there, like, yes, we're keeping all our options open.
Yeah.
You we decide. Don't want to get sued.
Yeah, but that said, you know, if you were, there was a law in I am not a crackpot. Shows that actually don't get a definitive answer should be forced to put that question mark on
right.
the titles.
Yeah.
And can you imagine how many titles you'd have to change at like the History Channel and all their kind of like, you know, quasi occult and paranormal and supernatural shows,
yeah,
or even like, yeah, and their conspiracy shows as sure. well, you know, mm-hmm. Hitler alive, the you know, or whatever, because well, like it's 80% of their
it would immediately turn into Ancient Aliens.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
All those shows. Yeah, yeah.
Finding Bigfoot.
All right, it is time to go around the dial. Our first stop is Tara Ariana.
Well, unlike the rest of you with your Real Housewives and your below deckings, I only watch one show on Bravo, hey. And that is called Flipping Out, which returns this week for its guess what season it is, anyone?
Seventh.
Nope.
Eighth.
Ten.
Ninth, wow. Sarah's.
Ninth? Oh my God.
It's the ninth season.
I went over.
Really? Believe it or not.
Has Jenny not killed him yet? What in the world?
No, like, she's pregnant again, Jesus. Judging by her later in the season talking heads, apparently. Anyway, Bravo sent over screeners for the first two episodes. It's having a two-night premiere event. Really, Bravo's flipping out. On Wednesday and Thursday this week. So I watched both of them this weekend. The thing about Flipping Out is, first of all, Jeff Lewis is hilarious to me. I know the whole premise of the show is he's a complete fucking monster. I just think he has not met enough people to get his sense of humor because it's very, very dry and mean, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
For reasons. You know why. But also, I love his partner, Gage, who he's still with, mostly because I'm still holding out hope. The whole time that he was on, during the SNL years that Seth Meyers was on, I was praying that someone there would like make a strong enough pitch for Seth Meyers to play Gage in a sketch about Flipping Out, even though no one cares about this show but me, and I know that. But now that he's on Late Night with Seth Meyers, maybe he could play Gage in a sketch on that show. Will not happen. There's still not enough house stuff in the show for my taste. In fact, the whole second episode, they barely do any house stuff at all, other than take down a chandelier from an extremely high ceiling that is legitimately tense and scary. However, it's still a good show. There's enough makeover reveals. There's a little brief mention of the Megan Fox, Brian Austin Green divorce in the premiere, because that was a storyline last season that he was redoing their house, and now that's like in suspended animation because they were maybe getting divorced, but maybe now they're not, question mark. Anyway, Flipping Out on Bravo, if you like HGTV programming but wish it was even bitchier somehow, it is the show for you. And for my
parents, Tara, here's what...
Yes,
sorry,
go
before
ahead.
You start. Here's what I would require to watch Flipping Out, because I watched it limitedly and I do see its appeal. Mm-hmm. I would need them to have, because I know the degree to which how fake this show is,
sure.
I would need them to have an episode where Zoila wins the lottery. And then moves out and sort of is granted her financial freedom that way. Because
like Rosario on Will and Grace?
Basically, yes. Like, I can't deal with, like, the cutesy, like, look at our funny, like, uh-huh. South American maid.
Sure.
Like, that bothers me.
Yeah.
Other than that, I agree with you that he's darkly funny, but also, mm-hmm. like, a purposeful pain in the ass.
Yes.
Anyway.
Well, I will tell you that I don't know about her winning the lottery, although she has had some plastic surgery on Jeff Lewis's dime
sure
in past seasons. She got an eye job, and I think she got a boob job too. But there's a scene where she's like supposedly doing her house manager job wearing like full Chanel earrings, and like she does several of her talking heads in Chanel earrings and a matching necklace. Like, come on. Anyway, for my plugs, I want to mention last week on Previously.tv, it was must-see TV week. We had a lot of fun, huge amount of Friends content if you're into that. So I will link that in the show notes where you can go to the page where all of the stories are collected. And also ongoing this week and all the summer, several Marathon Diaries are going on. Eve, as you hear this, if you listen to it the day it drops, will be starting her Sex and the City Marathon Diary today. And Daniel McEachern is still covering the middle-aged man disappearing up a middle-aged man's ass, the Louis Marathon Diary. Plus, Mark Blankenship is still in the throes of Damages. So you can check all of those out on Previously.tv.
And now we move to Allison.
Hello. I want to talk about Odd Squad, which is a kids show that is just starting its second season on PBS Kids. I don't know what the kids show watching quotient is that we have listening.
Well, there's that one parent that lets her kid listen in the car, complete with all our swearing and everything. So at least you got one.
Okay, lady, listen to me. This show, Odd Squad, is a brilliant piece of children's programming. It is of course, produced in Canada, as all great kids shows are. And it is a work of art. It is sort of a mix of like a police procedural, X-Files, Star Trek kind of thing. Hmm. These kids play agents who go out and solve odd problems. And it's mostly about math. I mean, that's the teaching element of it. But the kids in it are brilliant without being precious. It's not cheesy or, you know, overly cute. There's like this whole big slew of villains on the show. It's just some great world building and satire. And I highly recommend it if you have a kid in your life or if you just like hung over and watching PBS Kids, you know,
as
or whatever.
As you do.
What age is your child, right? for the sake of context? What is the age range that you would say this show is good for?
She's about to turn 7, but she started watching when she was 5, and I think it would be good for like a 5 to 10-year-old.
Okay.
She's obsessed with it, and I'm so glad. Like, so much crap is out there for kids to watch, and this is perfect for that age kid, and it's hilarious. So, I mean, I think I would watch it if I didn't have a kid. I'm not sure. It's hard to say.
Sounds like it shares some DNA with Gravity Falls, sort of.
Yeah.
You ever watch that show?
Yes.
And Mad Men, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. And it's very clever, so I really enjoy it. My plug is has nothing to do with children. It's about keeping up with the Kardashians. The only kids on that show are ones to feel very, very sorry for. I covered it last season, and I'm deep into this season on previously.tv, and it really makes me question a lot of things about myself and about my emotional and mental health.
America.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, really, it really does.
I mean, I love so many things about your coverage, but the way it causes you to do deep soul searching every week about like your response to the show, it's fascinating, like meta story about keeping up with the Kardashians for me.
It's
so.
The moderate ink blot.
Yes, thank you for that.
It seriously is. It's teaching me things about the narcissists I know in my life and the effects that they have had on me. And because I feel such sympathy for people that I should not feel it for. Yeah. And every week it happens to me. So please read that so it'll be worth doing.
please read. Please help.
So the other thing going on also on previously.tv is the Wheel of Murder, the next installment of which will be on Monday and oh no
Friday
the 15th, yep. Whenever that Friday. Is what's today Monday okay Friday and I will be writing about a show that's just come on to Netflix. They're calling it Netflix original content, but it isn't, so I don't know. It's called Marcella.
Oh, yeah.
And it stars Anna Friel.
Yeah, so. People are talking about that a lot. And just for people who don't know, the Wheel of Murder is every week Allison spins the wheel and covers a procedural show about crime from a different country in the world, and right down to what you should serve while you're watching it. So it's incredibly holistic. She's doing extremely important work.
Thank you.
Joe.
So, yeah, like I mentioned while we were talking about The Night Of, I finally got in gear and have watched Show Me a Hero, which was it last summer?
Yeah.
Like, was it that
was
long
it
ago
August,
or was it last fall?
August.
Good Lord. Okay. I have no excuse. You should show me no sympathy. But the good news is I finally watched it. I will just say, okay, here's the thing. I keep up with crap a lot better than I keep up with good shows because I have a lot more time in my day to not pay attention or like halfway to pay attention to things. And the stuff that I want to pay attention to just piles up and piles up and piles up. This is not a unique story. This is me. Anyway, Show Me a Hero is so good. You guys, you should really watch the show. It's amazing. And I feel like – and granted, like Oscar Isaac – amazing, got so much praise, totally well worth it. Golden Globe, deserved it. The Emmy race is going to be insane because it's going to be him and Courtney B. Vance, and I don't know who I'm going to want to win, and it's going to be crazy, and they're both going to lose to Bryan Cranston for playing LBJ, so whatever. But I want to talk about Catherine Keener, who plays Mary, I believe is her name, the sort of older neighbor who really goes on a journey in this show, and I feel like she wasn't as sort of loudly praised when the show was new, but I thought she was really fantastic. So much more so than my initial response to watching the trailer, which was like, Melissa Leo, what's happening there? So she's so good. She really just sort of like, she does. She goes on this, you know, journey, and the story of the housing development sort of reflects probably more through her and through the other characters in the show than it does through the Nick Wasisco character, who's sort of running on his own sort of parallel political journey. But like, God, like, so good. And I really hope that because it was last August, that it doesn't get entirely lost in the Emmy shuffle. This is a really competitive year for limited series with People versus O.J. Simpson. And American Crime was so good this year. And with the acting categories, they do the TV movies. So, like, Confirmation's in there. And All the Way, the LBJ movie, is in there. So it's going to be very, very competitive. And I'll be very, very much – Fargo is in that category. Like, it's all – there's a lot going on. So I'm going to be rooting hard for everybody in Show Me a Hero, and hopefully the Emmy voters have long memories. So my plug is related to that too. If you go to Decider.com, I did a whole bunch of articles, sort of Emmy advocacy articles for all the, you know, all the Emmy voters who read my stuff on Decider.com. Mm-hmm. So clearly I'm the unpaid campaign consultant for this. So if you want to go to Decider.com, if you just, you know, Decider.com/Joe-Reed, you can read all my stuff. I'll be tweeting the stuff out throughout the week as we lead up to Emmy nominations. So, yeah, go read my stuff.
And now, Sarah D. Patek.
So there's this show on Sundays at 9 on BBC America. I would ask if anyone else had seen it, but it's on Sundays at 9, so obviously you have not.
Nope.
It is called The Hunt. I had never heard of it before. My husband and I were out to dinner last night, and our barman, Mike, made us watch it. He's like, no, it's really great. The photography is amazing. And I was like, whatever. It is really amazing. Basically, it's like a nature show about the hunt. Last night's episode was set in the Arctic. Summer is waning. This polar bear has not caught a seal yet. This seal is sunning itself on the ice. It's super cute because it's a seal, but the polar bear is really skinny and you feel really sorry for her. And how is she going to be able to reproduce and hibernate and all that stuff? And like, they keep showing these different chases, like something really cute and fluffy, something also cute or at least admirable and skinny and hungry and killy, and you don't know who to root for. And it really is beautiful cinematography, and you're so torn, like, do I root for this Arctic bunny or do I root for the wolf? Anyway, if you literally have nothing else to do and only get one channel, Sunday nights are tough, but maybe find some airing that's on at like 3:30 in the morning and check it out. It's really amazing to watch. And I was raised in a household where basically I was only allowed to watch PBS and nature shows. I'm not super sure this is for kids. Mm. Spoiler, the bunny does not prevail. It just reminded me that nature shows are really wonderful and kind of like not soothing exactly, but it's really nice to not have to care about, I don't know, a housewife or like keeping track of some Byzantine drug dealing operation. Like, you can just watch it and absorb it. And yeah, it's a beautiful show. Speaking of housewives, my plug.
Oh no.
Real Housewives of New Jersey is back. So are my power rankings. If you were considering skipping this season because the additions from last year were terrible, good news. They have been disappeared. A new set of Dawn Summerses has arrived. These seem much more promising than the previous set. And best news of all, you know that Billy Joel in the 80s mated with the back of a city bus hairdo on Chris Lorita that I have been complaining about for like 15 years? He gone.
Hey!
Oh. Modified Tintin is a little weird. I'm excellent. Not going to clamber over anyone to make out with him still, but it's so much better. Didn't save him from bankruptcy or still believing in BLK or whatever that disgusting drink is. But anyhow, looks like a pretty fighty, exciting season in God's Little Acre. And I hope you all will join me for Real Housewives of New Jersey on Previously.tv.
Okay, so speaking of slow burns, as I mentioned earlier, Preacher gave it up last night. I really wanted to like this show because I really enjoyed the comic, which is bonkers. This show, I don't know what they are thinking. The best I could come up with is that they were so confident of the changes that they were making to the introduction of the general story that they thought, we'll make season one so slow and boring that when we really dig into the actual comic book content in season two, people's minds will be blown. But in the meantime, the show is dropping viewers like flies. It is slow, way too slow, especially compared to the source material. They changed the lead character. It might as well be a different character. In the comic book, when he starts, he is like basically not a preacher anymore, if he ever really was like a true preacher. And in the show, that seems to be the main drive of all the weird shit he's doing on the show, is that he just really wants to juice up those attendance numbers and get everybody in town on the same page to serve God. And it's not working. They really need to get in gear, and I don't think they're doing it. I know it's been renewed, which
weeks ago.
Yeah. So maybe they'll have a little sit and a little think about it, and season two actually get down to it, because there have been hints of the characters that make the show interesting, like Quincade. Quincannon is a very interesting character in the comic book. The cowboy character, who I won't say his name because it's a spoiler, but that is a very, very interesting character. And there was a glimpse of sort of a organizational thug-ish character in one of the episodes, this bald guy with the white hat, that I think maybe episode one or two, that we haven't seen since. And I just think they had decided to have a grand plan, and they stretched it too long or something. And it's way too slow of a burn for the kind of content that they need to present for this show. So,
too bad.
Preacher. Yeah.
Welcome to fucking Deadwood.
Greetings, EHG crew. I'd like to submit A Lie Agreed Upon, Part 1. Season 2, Episode 1 of Deadwood, perhaps the last best television Western series. Like it or not, change is coming to Deadwood, as represented by the new telegraph poles we see being set up as the stage rolls into town, carrying Seth Bullock's new family, as well as several employees for Joni Stump's new brothel. After anti-hero Hall of Famer Al Swearengen reads some disturbing correspondence about the town's lack of representation in the new political scheme of things, he walks onto the balcony of his gem saloon, followed by old loyal minion Dan Doherty and next-gen minion Silas Adams for this discussion about current events.
Messages from invisible sources, or what some people think of as progress.
Well, ain't the heathens used smoke signals all through recorded history?
How's that a fucking recommendation?
Well, it seems to me like, you know, letters posted one person to another is just a slower version of the same idea.
When's the last time you got a fucking letter from a stranger?
Bad news about Paul.
Bad news. Tries against our interests is our sole communications from strangers. So by all means, let's plant poles all across the country, festoon the cocksucker with wires to hurry the sorry word and blinker our judgments of motive, huh?
He's giving it more thought than me.
Ain't the state of things cloudy enough? Don't we face enough fucking imponderables?
Well, by God, you give the word, Al, and them poles will be kindling.
I guess this would be an appropriate time to mention the colorful language that made the show so noteworthy. By my casual count, this episode contains approximately 7 uses of the word fuck, 52 fuckings, 8 cocksuckers, and about another dozen various epithets, all in the space of 49 minutes, for an amazing ratio of 1.6 curses per minute. That alone should qualify the episode for the canon, as a monument to free fucking speech. Meanwhile, back at the gym, Swearengen, already pissed off by those imponderables, spies reluctant but resigned Sheriff Bullock coming out of the hotel after a dalliance with the town's most prosperous citizen, the widow Alma Garrett. Swearengen shouts down to chide Bullock about his afternoon delight, but Bullock doesn't take shit from anyone. Just ask the guy selling soap with a prize inside. The two have a staring contest until duty calls in the form of a gunshot from Tom Nuttall's number 10 saloon. Bullock issues a warning to Swearengen to stand ready to account for his slurs and strides off to take care of business. A case of mistaken identity at number 10 has resulted in the death of one of the several Dents who seemed to populate Deadwood, leading to the Solomon-like decision from Bullock, who's obviously got more pressing things on his mind.
Get up and tell your partner. My part sheriff was putting a bummer in my jacket and sending the poor fuck in here.
To what purpose?
Thinking maybe if Harry Wing wanted Bummer, mistaken him for me, threatened to murder, it'd be funny.
What's my liability, Mr. Bullock? Hey, getting pissed on provocation?
You didn't kill who you meant to, or mean to kill the man you did.
What's my liability? Worse in some way?
Box him and see he's buried. But I'm telling both of you, watch it.
Bullock returns to the gym to confront Swearengen, who has had time to reconsider his comments. He tries to be conciliatory, as much as he can without outright apologizing, and tries to distract Bullock with news of the political storm that's percolating. But the sheriff just can't put his pride aside. He removes his gun and badge, and the two engage in one of TV's epic brawls, beginning in Swearengen's office, moving onto the balcony, going over the balcony railing, and landing in the street just as the stage rolls into town. Now, prior to all this, allies of both combatants had gathered in the gym, looking to back their respective guy. Deputy Charlie Utter and Sol Starr, Bullock's hardware store partner on one side, Adams, Doherty, and Johnny Burns, the least bright of the Swearengen crew, for their boss. When Bullock and Swearengen crash into the muddy thoroughfare, Doherty claps the sheriff in the head with a shotgun, while Burns reluctantly shoots Starr and Utter, more or less seriously, respectively. Swearengen suddenly recalls he does have a knife hidden in his boot, but just as he's about to let his blade fly, he spies young William Bullock, who had been innocently farting and ogling the whores in the stagecoach just moments earlier. Cowed by the pie-eyed kid's duck face, he relents, offering a welcome to fucking Deadwood to the new arrivals.
Welcome to fucking Deadwood!
Swearengen's nemesis, Cy Tolliver, owner of the rival Belly Union, has been observing the proceedings along with Joni and Lila, one of his more philosophical whores. Disappointed by the stalemate where he had hoped for a double mortality, he laments being rarely that fucking lucky. Reeling from what has to be a concussion, a bloody Bullock nevertheless politely greets Martha Bullock and William, whom he will take under his wing in what strikes me as some biblical nod to marriage with deceased brother's wife. He arranges for their belongings to be taken to the new house he has had constructed for them before making a faceplant into the mud. We repair to parallel scenes of triage. At the gym, Swearengen's swearing has risen proportionately with his pain, the makeup reflecting after effects of his beatdown is wonderfully grotesque. And we hear this exchange with town mayor, hotelier, and slimeball A.B. Farnham.
Heavens. It's all like some great Greek battle.
Yeah, how about that fucking duck, huh? Scene of the respectable types, leaving us the ones that pay him regular, huh? So, that woman and child, Bullocks?
His wife and son.
How was Mr. Starr? How was Charlie Utter?
Shut up, Johnny! Detail Bullock's condition.
The worse for wear. No clarity to his look or focus, as I could sight in other combatants.
Touch me, E.B. I'll put your nose through your fucking brain. Now, did he state his further intentions?
To have his gun and badge back.
In what fucking tone?
Well, I'd shy from putting a name on it, Al. He was talking to an 8-year-old.
Sound like he'd be coming back for more?
Well, I'd hate to guess and be wrong.
Over at the hardware store, Doc Cochran tends to Starr's wounded shoulder, while Utter and Bullock hang out, apparently needing no more treatment than a damp cloth. In the middle of all this, the widow Garrick decides to play welcome wagon, bringing a gift basket to Mrs. Bullock and her son. Awkwardness ensues.
Mr. Bullock.
Mrs. Garrick.
How are you feeling, Mr. Starr?
I've puked twice.
Mrs. Garrick, Trixie.
Mrs. Garrick.
Mr. Otter.
Ma'am, don't be alarmed. A lot of this damage is old.
May I introduce my wife, Martha, and our son, William. Mrs. Alma Garrett.
How do you do? How do you do? How do you do, William?
How you do?
and Ellsworth, who superintends Mrs. Garrett's claim.
Ma'am. William.
How you do?
You've discovered us in distressing circumstances.
You think? Bullock tries to cover his ass, reminding Mrs. Bullock of letters he had purportedly sent, explaining his completely above-board relationship with the widow Garrett. But no one is buying it. Utter, who also serves as the town's postmaster, tries to lighten up the situation by claiming he loses more letters than he delivers. This is followed by an overenthusiastic laughter from those on hand. While all this is going on, the B-story of Joni setting out on her own continues. Tolliver tantrums through the scene before finally agreeing to let her go after more than a decade under his thumb. He redeems himself as a Class A dick in a bizarre bon voyage where he pours champagnes down the throats of his Bella Union working girls and informs Joni and her new partner, formerly the Borg Queen in Star Trek First Contact, that he will be taking a major piece of the action. But we're not quite done with the Bullocks. Seth escorts his instant family to their new abode. He declines to enter, promising he'll do so once he's retrieved his gun and badge. He walks away in the encroaching dusk to a voiceover of him constructing a letter to Mrs. Bullock, describing the construction of their home in details worthy of Popular Mechanics. The final scene has him returning to the hotel to embrace the widow Garrett, knowing that their affair has come to an end. Deadwood received critical acclaim for combining the violent world of the lawless community with dialogue worthy of Shakespeare. Even the most poorly educated of the townspeople express themselves in marvelously poetic and intelligent fashion. All I Agree Upon, Part 1, is a wonderful example of this through the stylish writing we came to expect from David Milch, whose resume includes Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue, along with excellent acting and cinematography. This episode marked a turning point in the maturation process for the community and many of the characters. The time had passed for a thumb to the nose, or perhaps middle finger extended, independence. Everyone is forced to grow up in a sense, unable to stop the creep of personal and political progress. Unfortunately, the show went a bit south in its third and final season with the introduction of the nefarious George Hurst. Viewers didn't get the chance for a satisfying ending, as Lost fans did. Just kidding. But news of a new Deadwood project may be just what Doc Cochran ordered.
Thanks, Ron. So I think we should start with Allison, who was our Television Without Pity Deadwood recapper. What do you think?
Okay. Damn you. I didn't want to start because even up until this moment, I am like so torn as to whether this should go in as a canon submission for Deadwood, which, not that I didn't love the episode, because I love it. Okay. And like, I remember recapping this. I was reminded of so many things. One, how much I hate Mrs. Garrett. Truly, truly and deeply and forever. That is a hate that goes on forever. And how much, you know, of course I love Timothy Oliphant. Maybe not as much as Tara, but almost. No one almost.
Including Mrs. Oliphant.
The guy is just freaking hot with his crazy mustache. I just like it'll be forever my love for him. The thing about this episode is, though, it has so many amazing things in it. Like, the fight, of course, is just, it's amazing. And the problem is there's so many great Deadwood fights. When he mentioned in his submission about the Hearst season, you know, there's some excellent fights in that season, and incredible throwdowns in the thoroughfare. It's just very hard to say whether this one tops that or whether it tops other Deadwood episodes. It's really hard for me to let it be submitted to the canon representing Deadwood for several reasons. I'm going to have to say no.
Interesting. All right, Tara, why don't you go next?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Ron for the submission and also mention you also, listener, can submit a canon or nonac for consideration. The information is at previously.tv. Go to that page and click on podcast. The submission information is there, correct?
Yeah.
I don't have the bone deep, you know, knowledge of the show that Allison does. Like, I know how it changes your relationship to a show to cover it this way, of course, especially in the kind of depth that you did on Television Without Pity. And but I was very pleased to get to revisit this episode, and I forgot that all of these things happened in the same episode. Bullock and Alma, I mean, I know you hated her, but God, they were so hot together. I was happy.
They were.
They had true.
Such great chemistry. And especially because Bullock is the angriest man in Deadwood / America. So for that mm-hmm. kind of passion and energy to be turned to sex made it hotter, in my opinion. Obviously, my feelings about that performer are well known, so I will not belabor them. But the moment that his family rolls in, literally, to town and sees him, like, having this very violent fight and, you know, he's all bloody and that the first thing he tries to do is reassure William that he's mostly okay is, like, I don't know how convincing that would be to an impressionable child. That would probably be super scary because of the aforementioned anger. And seeing his weird courtliness to these people and that they're supposed to be his new family is striking, and it's, you know, explored in interesting ways over the course of the season too, but like this is their introduction is rough yet fitting, and of course, you know, the welcome to fucking Deadwood line is great.
Oh yeah,
I also feel bad for poor Johnny, the dumb idiot who had to shoot people and no idea what he's doing, just afterwards so guilty about all of it and not getting any information about whether he's killed people. Like, poor Johnny.
That guy and John Hawks play that scene so well, where, like, neither one of them wants to be shooting anybody, and yet they're both just sort of, like, fumbling with their guns and, like, getting ready to do it. It's amazing. It's really well
knowing
done.
That actor goes on to play the probable actual murderer in Rectify, spoiler alert. It's interesting to see him come back in this role as, you know, as just an idiot as opposed to anyone evil. Johnny also always had a very good place in my heart for being such a fucking dope. The dumbest member of Al Swearengen's entourage, and that includes the ones who could barely speak English. Also mentioned about the Borg Queen. She came to town to work Shadowcaster. Literally, that was the weird horse lady from 90210 season 3 who totally banged Dylan and then sold her horse. Had crazy eyes.
Man.
So
there was some working Shadowcaster going on in this episode.
And I love too that it ends with a letter from Bullock, because that's a device that was always, I thought, used very well in the show for the reasons that Ron said. The language is beautiful, and in a letter it's even more considered than, you know, the kind of stuff that people are improbably saying in dialogue to one another. So I thought that was a very lovely way to close things out, and you know, symbolic, because he's building their house, which we never actually see in this episode. So I don't know.
But in that letter, mm-hmm. he is like skirting what he really should be saying too, because that letter is 80%, you know,
right.
wood details.
Right.
We got some pine. We got some spruce. We got some dovetail joints.
Shopping list. Yeah.
And I will try to be a good husband. Bye.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Anyway, this made me want to watch the show all over again. I keep pitching this, and we are going to run out of our current rewatch pretty soon, which is Brooklyn Nine-Nine, so this would be a real left turn if we were to take on Deadwood once again.
It's all about law and
truly.
Justice. And
true.
Frontier.
Yes. Front badges and so forth. Anyway, I was glad that I got to revisit it, but I'm interested to know what other people thought of it in terms of its canon worthiness, so I will turn it over to Joseph K. Reed.
I think more than anything, this episode, because it features the Swearengen Bullock fight, you think about like what this show does with like heroes and villains, where like when the series started, Al was the bad guy and Seth was the good guy in any kind of like traditional reading of like a Western, right? And then but then you look at where they got to even by this point, and this was only after one full season, their big huge fight comes not because of this like great like climactic battle or anything like that. It's because like Al is having the most annoying day ever, where he gets like bad news from Yankton, and then like the whatever telegraph poles are annoying him. That whole scene with Dan, right. I'm so glad that got clipped. It's amazing. We're like, Dan cannot put the right foot forward in that conversation. It's so funny. And then he's got his like impending kidney stone ordeal to like process, and that whole thing is coming down
his
the pike.
Bleeps.
And like, Yeah. Oh my God. It is. And just remembering that is so harrowing. Yes. So that, and then it's ultimately comes because like he says something like he's basically trolling Bullock in Thoroughfare. And like Bullock is just like, won't have it because he's got his own problems to deal with. And it's interesting because like in the submission, he refers to Swearengen as an anti-hero. And I don't even know if I would go that far. I think he's so, the show makes him so much of just like a complicated person who's just dealing with logistical issues and also like, you know, old West, well,
he's
archetypes
like, he's
or whatever.
Mercenary, but like his fortunes are tied to the town's fortunes. So it seems at times that he has other people's interests at heart too, which I think, you know, muddles the, he's a villain waters, but he's
right.
Yeah. He's not an anti-hero. I agree.
I don't think I would call him any of those things. I don't think he's a hero or a villain or an anti-hero. I think the show does such a good job of like making the town mm-hmm. such an ecosystem that you don't really have that. And that's what makes the whole thing so fascinating. And then like the fact that there's all this kind of violence, but it's such a funny show where like they're in the – when Al's eyeing down Bullock from the balcony and they hear the gunshot go off and he just goes to Dan just like, tell me that's not Tom Nuttall taking the easy way out. And I was just like
yes,
dying. It's so funny. And William farting in the – whatever stagecoach with the whores and all of that. And then with the whole Cy Tolliver subplot, which is, you know, clearly like a back burner thing from everything else that's happening here. But like watching his impotent rage and just like he, there's nowhere for him to go with it. And he's basically just like his teeth are chattering.
Can
he's
I tell
so
you
mad.
That Cy Tolliver's character makes me more uncomfortable than Al Swearengen by far. Like there is
me
some
too.
Sort of deep, creepy black bile evil in that guy that
sure. yep.
that
yeah
doesn't exist in Al Swearengen. And it I always on first oh. watch I really didn't like that storyline. Like I was always that was always my least favorite part of Deadwood, but right. like it is it puts Al Swearengen in context, I think, where yeah
absolutely
and,
absolutely
like, where he isn't the greatest of all evils or necessarily evil with a capital E in this show, but oh god, that character is so fucking creepy.
Yeah,
he's creepy.
Go
he
ahead,
completely
Al.
Lack. Oh, I was going to say that I think the difference between him and Al is that Al has empathy, as you could see when he stops from killing Bullock when he looks into the eyes of the kid, like he remembers himself as a child and the whole storyline about Al, his own childhood and his mom leaving him and all that. But Cy has none of that, like. And he grossed me out watching this the first time so badly that seeing him again and all of his makeup, it just really got me.
One last thing on Ty Oliver where you can tell he's evil. White hair, black eyebrows. Never trust a guy, white hair, black eyebrows.
That's true.
Been established.
And then even in the scene leading up to the fight with Al and Bullock when they're in Al's quarters upstairs and he's like – and he's needling Bullock and he's getting at him. And then like there's a moment where he knows he's gone too far and you could see it in his eyes and he's just like, oh, hell. Like I'm really – like I pushed the wrong button. And then he sort of makes the decision to like – double down on it anyway because like, well, I'm already here. And it's just Ian McShane's so good mm-hmm. in this role. And then there's also I just wanted to mention the scene towards the end of the episode where Dan is sort of yelling at Johnny about like, well, this is what's happening. America's coming to Deadwood and we're gonna have to deal with a whole lot of fucking people who we don't want to have to deal with, and you know, it's all a bunch of, you know, untrustworthy people out there. And the Milch was able to sort of throw big themes into the episode in a way that was like very recognizable, and yet you never felt like it was like record scratch, like time to, you know, learn what it's all about. And conversations like that were really good towards that end. I think this is an episode that does all of the things that I love about Deadwood. It does it really well. And the second season, this sets up everything that happens in the second season. And the second season of Deadwood is like, I think maybe my favorite season of television ever in terms of just absolutely blown away by what it does. So I love it. Sarah?
I don't like this show.
Oh, it kills me.
I know. I just don't. It's not for me. Like, I chuckled a couple times. I get what people like about it. It's not one of those things where I'm like, what? Like, I get it. It's just, it doesn't work. It's like too mannered in a way that I can't deal with. I shouldn't ever have read that New Yorker article about David Milch because I can't unknow any of that, like personal horse shit, like that he dictates literally everything. Like that just is, he is super annoying to me. I was actually hoping that revisiting the show, because I had seen a couple of episodes before, and I think one of them was this one. I was hoping that I would feel differently and sort of would have some distance from it, and that, that I would feel that I would be like, oh, and sort of be tempted to do a sober second thought watch of the show. Yeah, that's not gonna happen. I don't think. And I know this is heresy, especially on this podcast, but I don't care for Oliphant's acting choices here. yeah, sorry. I'll let myself out right after I observe that I, who usually love both Oliphant and a mustache, think he's not, like, I would fuck Saul Starr.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
first.
Both then at again, once, right? Isn't
Saul
that
Starr
what?
Looks
no?
like my husband. Sorry. That's... yeah. Yeah. I like him shorter and Irish looking. Yeah. I will say, though, this was a really great canon presentation. Ron, you should really consider voiceover work or reading audiobooks. It was funny. I laughed. I cried. It was better than the actual episode. It was enjoyable to see Anne arriving in town to work Shadowcaster on a professional basis. I did chuckle a few times, but yeah, this, I don't really feel that, you know, I even have a qualified vote. This just isn't, I can't speak to whether it's like typical of the show, and I just don't like the show. So
Allison, the fights you're talking about having some real good beatdowns in season three, are we referring to the Dan Captain Turner?
We are referring to that.
Yes. That was certainly more choreographed and, you know, more...
gushy.
Yes, gushy.
Eyeball.
Yeah, like really, like somebody spent their time, you know, setting that whole scene up. But, like, this is the, you know, alpha, you know, two alphas in the town actually having a fight. This is, you know, that other one was the best of the henchmen bout, you know, that's the UFC
true.
Bout.
That's the undercard.
This is the, yeah, this is the actual, this is like when, you know, Vince McMahon and like some manager back in the 80s would have a fight, you know, Mouth of the South versus Vince McMahon. Let's do it. I'm actually a little bit surprised that you didn't think this one was canon worthy. To me, like this is such a good tight episode that sets up so much of what's to come in the season. And one of my favorite things is the Al Swearengen office powwow where he just talks a little strategy over some whiskey, and it's such a sing-songy kind of flow to it where, you know, he's sort of talking to but through everybody that's in the room as he sort of formulates his strategy as he's talking about the facts of the whatever is going on. In this case, you know, the Yankton problem. I could just watch episodes of that. Where that falls for me, and it's not in this episode, is when he starts talking to Chief Head in the Box.
yes.
That wasn't the greatest choice, I think, for that character. But I think everybody said everything about this episode that I like. So I'm going to just go to the vote. So let's see. Starting with Allison, you said nay.
With regrets.
All right. And Tara?
I'm going to say yay for the reason that Joe said it does all of the good things Deadwood does well in a nice tight package. So yay for me.
And Joe?
I'm going to agree with everything that I said, too, so I'm going to say yay.
I'm going to agree with Tara agreeing with you, if that's okay, in a proxy agreement. So
wait,
that means...
you didn't... Sarah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sarah.
Yes to Ron, no to this episode.
Okay, sorry, Sarah. You were such a... You said you were almost abstaining, so... But,
yeah.
But yes. No matter, because 3 versus 2... That means Deadwood Season 2, Episode 1, A Lie Agreed Upon, Part 1. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and a Loser of the Week. Tara has a winner.
Late breaking winner, Carrie Coon, star of The Leftovers, is going to be the female lead of Fargo Season 3. Hooray for her.
So I think excited.
Really great. Love her. Love Fargo. Love the idea of her on Fargo. This season apparently is going to be set closer to the present day, like in the smartphone era. I think that's about all we know other than Ewan McGregor in a dual role as brothers who are not twins. Dunno. I don't know if there's chin putty involved, but I guess we'll see.
Have they revealed what the connection is to?
Not that I am aware of. Okay. Right. But it's apparently, and I learned today, I assumed it was going to be coming back this fall, but not so. It's not going to be back until 2017. So it'll be around with Homeland, I guess. So sit tight because they're going to start production on that soonish.
All right. Loser of the week.
Roger Ailes. Couldn't have happened to a nicer network after Gretchen Carlson filed suit against the Fox News honcho for sexual harassment. The Us 2 multiball began. I am not surprised to learn that she was not the only one. Of course, his spokesman was like, these accusations are, you know, decades old and totally baseless. Like, that's not how it works.
No.
Dickheads.
Also, one of them was from someone who was 16 at the time. Like, ugh, gross. That plus the revelation of, like, he took out his genitals and they were red like raw hamburger. That's his nickname now forever. Sorry, everybody.
Good thing I don't eat meat. Yeah.
Hey, speaking about good things, you know what time it is? It's game time.
Not burger time?
Gross. All right, everybody, this is the sixth game time of the season. I believe Value Guess won last week, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, or last time, sorry. Yep. Tara and Joe up top with two, Value Guess with one, Sarah with zero. Today we are playing More Chicken, More Egg, a sequel to Chicken and Egg from Rob Hartman.
Oh, Rob.
Hartman!
In More Chicken, More Egg, I will read you a pair of similar TV shows, and you tell me which came first.
Ooh.
If you answer correctly, you get a chance at a second point if you can tell me the year the earlier show debuted.
Ooh.
All right?
Yep.
We have 52 questions today, so let's get going and throw it to Picky 3000 for our order.
We will start with Joe.
All right, so our order is Joe, Allison, Tara, Sarah. Are we ready to play More Chicken, More Egg?
Yes, sir.
Let's get cracking.
Ah.
Oh, no.
Joe.
I'm not sorry at all.
According to Jim, or King of Queens, which show debuted first?
Darn it. I feel like this is real close. Huh. I feel like King of Queens never got quite to the level of, like, I can't believe this show is still on that according to Jim did. So I'm going to guess according to Jim. Damn it!
Beat by about 3 years. King of Queens, September 21st, 1998.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
All right, Allison, here's one for you.
Yes?
The Real Housewives of Orange County or Desperate Housewives?
So I'm saying which one it was earlier?
Which debuted first?
Desperate Housewives.
Nice. Correct. Now, for an extra point, do you know the year it started?
2003.
Ooh, very close.
The class.
2004.
Really?
Yeah. But a year and a half later was The Real Housewives. That was the first one, right? Orange County?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Tara Ariano.
Yes, sir.
Criminal Minds or Numb Threeers?
Oh, God. Numb Threeers.
Correct. Year?
Year 2002.
Way off. 2005. Crap. 2005. And only about half a year separates those two shows.
Okay.
Sarah Bunting, your first question is 21 Jump Street or Square Pegs?
Oh, shit. Square Pegs.
By quite a bit. Yeah, 5 years.
Wait, give it a chance to say the year.
I know.
Oh, okay.
I didn't say.
All right.
84?
82. 82 versus 87.
That was a lot. Wow. 82. Yeah.
All right. Joe Reed, She's the Sheriff, or Bosom Buddies?
She's the Sheriff. I have no idea when She's the Sheriff happened. Was that Angie Dickinson? Am I thinking of the wrong thing?
Yep.
I don't know. It wouldn't help me anyway. I'm going to say that. She's the Sheriff. Damn it.
By quite a bit. 7 years difference.
Really?
1980 versus 87.
She's the Sheriff was 87?
Yeah. Isn't that
Rhymedy.
The...
What's Suzanne Summers,
I Master think. Lady? Yeah.
Oh, Suzanne Summers. Okay.
Oh. Police woman is Angie Dickinson. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. Allison. Hunter.
Yes.
Hunter or TJ Hooker.
Oh. Oh my gosh. I'm going to say Hunter was first.
Incorrect.
Oh.
TJ Hooker, March 82. Hunter, September 84.
So Hunter was the TJ Hooker knockoff or whatever. I was, you know, thinking that was the same show. Okay.
Got Fred Dreyer online too to answer that question.
For Tara.
Yeah.
Shout out to Linda Holmes. Your shows are Scarecrow and Mrs. King.
Yep.
I always immediately associate
of
with Linda.
She would be very happy to hear that, I'm sure.
Scarecrow and Mrs. King or Heart to Heart.
Heart to Heart.
Ooh.
And the year?
19.
I'm going to give you a little hint. You're okay. Correct so far.
I'm going to say 79er.
Man, that is our first extra point.
Wow. Yes.
Heart to Heart, August 79. Scarecrow and Mrs. King, 83.
Okay.
83. All right. Sarah, speaking of Deadwood Season 3, Coach or Major Dad?
Oh, Christ. Coach.
Yeah.
Correct.
Nice.
And the year?
The year that Coach debuted was 19. How am I doing so far? 88.
Oh, 89. And barely. February 89.
Damn it.
Versus September 89 for Major Dad, same year. Joe, blowout or flipping out?
Oh, shoot. Okay. Blowout.
You are correct.
Nice.
I think that was the first of the out shows.
I think you're right.
So that would have been, it would have been before Flipping Out and before Workout. Like, oh man. Okay. When did Project Runway? 05.
04.
Man.
04.
Sounded versus, so confident.
I know.
versus 07 for Flipping Out. So quite a bit later. Yeah. All right, Allison.
Yep.
Pawn Stars or Hardcore Pawn?
Oh. Pawn Stars.
You are correct.
Well done.
And
in
the year?
The year of 2009.
What? Nice. Wow.
Well done.
Okay. Oh,
2009 versus 2010.
Literally. No idea. That is amazing.
Nice.
Well, there's only so many years.
The universe provides.
Super Nanny, Tara.
Yep.
Or Nanny 911.
Super Nanny. God, that was.
You know, I misread
say,
the. Sorry, just I misread the. Because the. I'll give you a little hint. The date.
Right.
The actual number of the month is 7, and I read the show as Super Nanny 7, and I immediately created this whole show. That's sort of like a Super Friends like version of Super Nanny.
Furious 7 of nannies?
No, it's like Super Nanny. Okay. Like
all right. Super Nanny, let's say that was 2003.
4.
Damn it.
Yeah, and Nanny 911, also 2004. Okay. Half a year later. Sarah, Wife Swap. Or Trading Spouses, both U.S. versions.
Mm.
Wife swap or trading spouses? Shit. Trading spouses.
Whoa.
2004.
Hey!
What? Wow. Total guess!
I assume that, obviously, because they're U.S., there was U.K. first, probably?
Yeah, I think so.
So that would explain why both of those debut very close to each other, July 1st and September 26th.
Mm.
Yeah. Joe Reed, the L word, or Queer as Folk U.S.?
Queer as Folk U.S. Okay. Now I'm trying. I'm trying to remember whether they were post 9/11 or not. I don't know if that matters. 2000.
Nice.
No.
And barely. Excellent. December 3rd, 2000 versus 04 for the L word. Allison, the Borgias, or the Tudors?
Yeah. Oh. The Tudors. 2012.
Oh, quite a bit off. 2007.
Oh, okay. The Borgias, I did not watch it. Clearly.
Yeah. Tara, Whoopi or Bette?
Oh my God, Bette.
Okay. Now, was that a talk show or a sitcom?
No, they were sitcoms.
No, that was a sitcom.
Both of them were very short-lived sitcoms. What did I say it was? Bette.
Yep.
Okay. 2004.
Should have stopped. 2000.
Ah!
2000.
Dang it.
All right, Sarah, bring us into our first score break. Pan Am or... Anybody want to guess who the other show is?
The Playboy Club?
Yeah, or the Playboy Club.
Shit. Oh, man. I am so torn. In two directions. Spoiler. Playboy Club.
You are correct.
Wow, nicely done.
And get this.
2006.
Oh, no. 2011. Wasn't that long ago.
Weird.
6 days.
6 days apart.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, they were the same season. Apart.
The 19th of September versus the 25th of September. All right, that brings us into our very first score break. Tara, let's hear the scores.
Very tight game. Joe has 3 points. Allison has 4 points. Sarah and I are tied with 5 points each.
All right, so let's get back to More Chicken, More Egg. Back to Joe with number 17.
Spread Eagle.
Spread Eagle.
Everybody Hates Chris or Malcolm in the Middle.
Malcolm in the Middle.
You are correct. And the year it started.
Okay. Malcolm in the Middle.
I feel like that's technically still on.
Yeah, right?
Just keep going.
Oh, I'm trying to remember whether it goes back into the 90s or not. I'm going to say 01?
2000.
2000.
And 2005 for Everybody Hates Chris.
Yeah.
Allison, Kitchen Nightmares or Restaurant Impossible?
Oh, I've never heard of Restaurant Impossible. Kitchen Nightmares.
You are correct.
And it seems like it's been on for a long time, but 2007.
You are correct.
Hey!
Nice. Nicely done. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. These are guesses with the years. I have no idea.
Tara?
Yeah.
Cashmere Mafia or Lipstick Jungle?
Oh, God. Lipstick Jungle?
Incorrect, but only by 1 month.
Okay, but they... I know I don't get a point for this, but they're both 2008, right?
You are correct.
Okay.
How do you know that?
Because we were all Bravo still then.
Yep. Right.
Yep.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting, Red
they
Shoes...
They were very highly regarded in TV Big Shot, I will say.
Oh, my God. Oh. I forgot about that.
Yeah,
wow.
I haven't.
Dave needs to go lie down. Game time over.
I want to track down the guy who realized how he can game the system literally day two of that,
mm-hmm.
and the contest was over on day two. Nobody else could win.
Nope.
It was amazing. told him they didn't do it. Nobody listened. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, Red Shoe Diaries or Silk Stockings?
Oh, jeez.
Oh man, you know who loved silk stockings? Stockings? My dad.
Aww.
The show?
Mitzi, what's her name fan? That said, I believe the answer is Red Shoe Diaries.
You are incorrect.
What?
Silk Stockings.
Really?
November 91. Red Shoe Diaries, June 92.
Shocking.
Really? Sorry, Dad.
Joe, here's two shows I always get confused. Profiler or The Pretender.
Oh, shit.
Recently both mentioned by Lisa Schmeiser in a post on Musty TV Week.
Oh, my God. All right. I'm going to say The Pretender.
Nice.
Now, I'll give you a hint here, Joe. The hint is these shows are 2 days apart.
Whoa.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So extra well
92?
Done.
92?
96. 96.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, way off.
Allison, Walker, Texas Ranger, or Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman?
Oh, no. Oh, God. Oh, God. Walker, Texas Ranger.
Oh, no.
No.
Same really? Year, 93, but early and late.
Wow. Yeah. I would have thought Walker was me later.
Freak me. Out. Tara.
Yes.
Veronica's Closet or Just Shoot Me.
Oh, boy. Just Shoot Me.
You're correct.
Okay.
Nice.
95?
97
Damn.
For both shows.
Yeah.
Sarah, Judging Amy or Providence?
Judging Amy.
Oh, I'm shocked
Providence.
Again.
Another early 99 versus late 99
Boy.
Matchup. Joe, the Munsters or the Addams Family?
Oh, damn it. Crap. The Munsters?
No, but get this. Same month, same year, September 64.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So obviously that means there was a British show based on those earlier, if I'm learning anything. Those monsters. Was that the show? Allison.
Yes.
The Beverly Hillbillies or Green Acres?
Y'all would think I would know this. So hold on. Let me think about it. The Beverly Hillbillies.
Nice.
Correct.
Nice. Oh, okay. And in 1960.
Ooh, that was close. 62.
Oh, man.
And Green Acres was 65.
Wow.
Tara.
Yeah.
Continuing our Everybody Gets Classic Pair-Ups portion of the show.
Sure.
The Rockford Files or Columbo?
Columbo?
That's okay. My excellent Columbo image.
Yeah, that was great.
Thank you.
This pirate Columbo.
19...
73. Oh, no. 68.
Shit.
74 for the Rockford Files.
Oh, gosh.
Sarah, Lassie or Flipper?
Oh, God. Lassie.
Yep. Year?
57.
Oh, 54.
Whoa.
Yeah.
All right, Joe, CSI Miami or Law & Order Criminal Intent?
CSI Miami or Law & Order Criminal Intent. Criminal Intent.
Yep.
Nice. That's a toughie.
Yeah. The year would have been 02?
02 was Miami. 01, October.
Ugh.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Wow.
It really helped the nation heal.
Yeah.
Allison, Doctor Who
yep.
reboot or Battlestar Galactica reboot?
Doctor Who, Medicine Woman.
Walker Doctor Texas Who. Reboot.
No, Battlestar Galactica was first.
Really?
Yeah.
I
really
guessed that.
04 what? For Battlestar Galactica, 05 for Doctor Who.
Gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried to watch that new Doctor Who, and there was garbage cans that turned people plastic or something. I'm like, nope, out.
Yeah.
Tara.
Yeah.
The Closer or Saving Grace?
Oh my God, The Closer.
Yep.
Okay, the year is 2000.
Even?
Yes, 2000.
2005.
Shit!
Saving Grace, 2007.
Okay.
All right, Sarah, bring us into our second score break, Cold Case or Without a Trace.
Cold Case.
What?
Without a
I'm
Trace.
Shocked.
September 26, 2002. September 28, 2003. You're apart.
Wow.
All right, let's hear the scores.
Oh, my God, it's still so close. Joe and Sarah are tied with 6 each. Allison has 7. I have 8.
All right. So.
Anybody's game.
I agree. Here we go. Back to Joe. Father Knows Best or Leave It to Beaver.
Oh, God damn it. Leave It to Beaver.
What?
Father Knows Best. 54, Leave It to Beaver, 57.
Would never have
That's a little
that.
Later than I thought it would be. Yeah. Allison, General yeah. Hospital or All My Children?
Oh, Joe is so oh, mad right
Joe's
now.
So mad right now.
I know.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Joe. Oh, man. Now I feel like I have to get it right.
Will Allison
I worked on a major anniversary campaign for the show, so I would
oh,
know.
Oh, no. Is it All My Children?
Oh.
All right, Joe. Let's see
so
if Joe knows.
Sorry.
Well, the 50th was in 2013. So, what is that? 63?
Yes, you are correct. No points. I'll give you a Dave point for that one.
All right.
Thank you.
Dave point being noted now.
Tara, Star Search or The Gong Show?
The Gong Show. Sorry, I was just marking Joe's day point. And I will say the year of The Gong Show is 1969.
76.
Whoa.
76. Yeah, you could tell
really?
By the set it was 70s. Okay. Stupid. All right, Sarah. Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood or Captain Kangaroo?
Ooh.
Mr. Rogers.
Oh, no. And by 13
Whoa.
Years,
what?
Captain Kangaroo
God
started in 55.
Damn it.
Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood started in 68.
I've guessed wrong on every one of Sarah's.
All right, Joe. I know you watch both these shows religiously. Hannah Montana or Lizzie McGuire?
Only one of them did I see the movie in the theater.
With me.
I remember. Lizzie McGuire.
Nice.
Nice.
I have a sister. the year... 2003.
2001.
Boy.
Oof.
January.
Wow.
All right, Allison, Boy Meets World or Saved by the Bell?
Oh. Okay. Saved by the Bell.
Nice.
Really?
Oh, and I want to say 87.
89 Ugh. Versus 93.
Damn it.
Yeah. All right, Tara.
Yeah.
Blossom or Clarissa Explains It All?
Blossom.
Says with authority, despite
yeah.
only a 3-month difference.
I know. 91. Whoa!
Nice.
What? Damn it.
All right, nice. Sarah, Sister, Sister, or Moesha?
Moesha.
Sister, Sister, 94. Moesha, 96. Joe Reed, Lou Grant, or... Trapper John M.D.
Oh, fuck.
Well, like Trapper John.
Joe did not work on an anniversary campaign for either of those shows.
For neither of those shows.
Trapper John.
Never too late.
Lou Grant?
Hey.
Okay. As for the year, God, I'm going to get this hilariously wrong. 78.
Ah, oh, 77, Joe.
Ah! I was literally going to say 77.
All right, Allison, pay attention to the hints.
Yes.
Give me a break, okay. Exclamation point, or what's happening, double exclamation point.
Okay, what's happening? And that was a beautiful time in history. Happening was
78 76.
Damn, God. It
Tara Ariano.
Yes.
WKRP in Cincinnati or a show I've never heard of, Hello, Larry.
Oh, that was a Three's Company spinoff, I believe. Oh. It was that.
Oh, yeah.
If I recall correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to say, shit. This is going to be one of those where they were both like 3 days apart or something. God. Hello, Larry.
WKRP in Cincinnati, yes. September 78 versus Hello, Larry, January 79.
So not close at all, really.
78, 79. About 4 months, 4 or 5 months. Okay, so Three's Company had The Ropers.
Yeah.
Hello, Larry. Three's a crowd.
Yeah.
Is that it?
I think so.
Three? That makes sense. Three spinoffs. Three's a company. Oh, so. We get it. Very
Battlestar
meta.
Galactica also.
Doctor Who.
Sarah Bunting, both shows I know you love, Hee Haw or Soul Train?
Basically the same show.
Yep.
Yes, basically. I've been guessing my instincts and I've been wrong every time, so let's go against that and say Soul Train.
Oh no!
You got double Costanza'd.
Okay, so Hee Haw was the summer of 69, and Soul Train was the fall of 71.
Gosh.
Yeah.
I guess that.
All right,
Soul
Joe.
Train!
Inside Edition or Entertainment Tonight?
Ooh.
Oh.
Mary Hart's still around.
Doing it live. Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm going to say Entertainment Tonight.
You're correct.
Nice. I'm going to say 1986.
Quite a bit earlier. 81. Inside Edition, 89.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Quite wow. Allison, Nightline or 2020?
Oh, Nightline?
2020, summer 78, damn. Nightline, spring 80. Mm. Tara Ariano.
78.
Yeah. Meet the Press or 60 Minutes.
Oh, God. Meet the Press.
What? Meet the what?
Meet the what Press. Meet the Press.
I can't even hear you.
Meet the Press. God, that was probably like the second show on television. I'm going to say 19. Like 51.
Yeah, you're on the right track. Even earlier.
48.
47.
God.
Wow.
And 60 Minutes. Anybody want to take a crack when that started?
They broadcast it to the 4 TVs that there were. It's crazy.
60 Minutes. Like,
60 Minutes, about 50 years old?
Yeah, it's old.
68.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just the longest running in primetime, I guess.
Probably.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
All right, bring us into our next
score
break.
The youngest show on CBS.
Right.
Sarah D. Bunting, The Jerry Springer Show, or The Maury Povich Show?
Oh.
Povich.
Yep.
Whoa!
This is the one I get right. Jesus. 90.
One.
Oh.
Both September 91. Gosh. A few weeks from each other. Yeah. All right. Whoops. Let's hear the scores.
Okay.
Everybody has one question left.
All right. Someone could, well,
just
anyway.
Give the scores.
Okay, fine. Sarah has 7 points. Joe and Allison are tied with 9 each. I have 12.
All right. Everybody's last question. But here's the thing. 4 points you can get on this question.
Oh.
Whoa.
I'm going to read you 3 shows.
Mm-hmm.
You get which one answered first. You get to guess the years for all the other ones.
Oh, boy.
All right.
Yep.
And that one, of course. So you get to guess years. All right.
Yep.
Joe, Enlightened, The United States of Terra, The Big C.
Okay. Enlightened, United States of Terra,
yeah.
And The Big C. Okay. It's United States of Terra.
You are correct. And now you get to guess the year of each one.
Okay.
Let's start with United States of Terra.
United States of Terra was 2010.
Oh, 09.
2009?
Oh, 09. January, yeah. 09. All right.
You still get to guess the other two,
yep,
right?
You still get to guess the other two, whatever order you want.
Okay.
The shows are The Big C and Enlightened.
It's just a matter of whether they were spring or fall shows, because I remember the Emmy years that they were in. The Big C was, oh, God, 2011?
2010.
Damn it. Okay. And Enlightened was... Now is it just the next year? 2012. No, 2011.
You're off by 1 year.
2011.
Yeah. You
God
had the right
damn it.
Spacing. Just yeah, you're
I
over
did.
1 year. Yeah. 2009, 2010, 2011. All right.
No excuse. That
Allison.
Yes.
Here are your shows: The Mentalist, Psych, and Lie to Me.
Oh, Lord.
Mentalist, Psych, and Lie to Me. And as a reminder, if you don't get the first part right, you don't get to guess the years.
All right, all right, all right, all right.
That sounded like me, like,
the?
First you have to eat your broccoli, and then you might get a few bites of ice cream.
Pain.
The Mentalist. Damn.
Sorry,
is it Psych?
Psych. Which was
shit,
2006, all... Mentalist 2008, Lie to Me 2009.
Wow.
Yeah. All right, Tara.
Yes.
Everwood,
mm-hmm.
One Tree Hill,
mm-hmm.
and The OC.
Oh, cripes.
Oh, right up
okay.
your alley.
One Tree Hill.
What?
Everwood was first September 2002.
Wow.
The OC, August 2003.
Wow.
One Tree Hill. September 2003.
I just think of that show as having been always on. Yeah. Like, anyway. All right.
All right. Our last question of the game, unless we have a tie. Sarah D. Bunting, your shows are Life Goes On, The Wonder Years, and Doogie Howser, M.D.
Oh, boy.
Okay. Life Goes On, Doogie Howser. What was the other one?
Wonder Years.
Doogie Howser.
The Wonder Years was first in 88, and the other two were
wow,
September 89.
Yeah,
really?
All right, let's hear the final scores, please.
On, but...
All right, Sarah had 7, Allison had 9, Joe had 10, I had 12.
All right, so Tara takes it,
nice
but
job.
Let's do our tiebreaker for Shits and Giggles.
Okay.
We'll give 3 Dave points to the person who can first answer. Which of these two shows started first? Tales from the Crypt or Tales from the Dark Side?
Tales from the Crypt.
I wonder what the answer is.
Tales from the Dark Side.
Oh, Tara picks up that the points were still there to be had with Tales of the Dark Side from 84 and Tales of the Crypt 89. All right, we have one more.
What?
This was just 4 Dave points.
Okay.
Per Rob's instructions.
Oh.
So I'm going to give... 5 Dave points for the first person who can answer which of these shows started first. Flip That House or Flip This House?
Flip This House.
Yeah, Joe gets it. Flip This House, July 05. Flip That House, August 05.
Wow.
Whoa.
Tara. Tara.
Nice. All right,
job,
well
buddy.
Done. Okay, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We took HBO's limited series, The Night Of, for a spin, and Sarah definitively told us exactly what happened with D.B. Cooper. Forever and ever, it is settled. We went around the dial with stops at Flipping Out, The Odd Squad, Show Me a Hero, The Hunt, and Preacher. We inducted Deadwood... Allegri Pond Part 1 for the canon. We crown winners and losers of the week. And Tara was a winner of More Chicken, More Egg. Remember.
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
I puked twice.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Distressing circumstances.
Joe Reed.
Forgive me, enlightened.
And Allison Lohuff.
I'm sorry about all of it.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Great.
Here's your hardware. And as he looks a cunt anyway, I would like you to have this rose.
Aww.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.